Great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is November 21st, 2012. And as you may know, if you've been here before, I'm talking about and we're exploring refuges, this idea of what is it in our lives, inside ourselves, as well as inside our circumstances, that protects us, gives us sanctuary, feeds us, refuels us, repairs us, inspires us, lifts us, buoys us, carries us along in a good way, like a beautiful warm current. What are those things? And classically, as you may know, in Buddhism, there are said to be three primary refuges, and then there are of course, other refuges that you can think about in terms of the qualities of an awakened being or the divine abiding places, the perfections of a bodhisattva, and so forth. And then in general, outside of Buddhism, there are many ways to think about refuge. Reason, science, your cat, chocolate chip cookies, friends. Maybe you like who's in the White House, depending on whatever your interests are. So there are many things we can take refuge in. And in the Buddhist frame, the three primary refuges, the three jewels, are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The teacher, as well as the capacity for awakening inside each one of us, that's Buddha. Dharma is truth. That's what I talked about last week. The truth of things, as well as a truthful account of the truth of things. The body of teachings, broadly defined, including the teachings in a Buddhist frame, which is our frame here, my frame here at least, the teachings in Buddhism. That's the Dharma. And then there's Sangha, which is a gathering of people on the path. That's the original meaning. It began as a respect for the people who are very far along in practice and taking refuge in their teachings and their modeling after the Buddha passed away. And then over time, the notion of Sangha became more spread out to include the gathering as a whole. For example, there's a well-known interchange in the Dharma between the Buddha and Ananda. Ananda, his cousin and his attendant, someone with an amazing auditory memory, Ananda. And Ananda turned to the Buddha one day and looked at the gathering of people around and said, "Look, noble sir, this is half the holy life." In other words, this is the half that's out there contrasted to the half that's in here. Why would he say half? Why wouldn't he say 58% or 24%? He said half. He was making the distinction, that which produces the holy life in here compared to that which produces it, as it were, supports it from out there. And the Buddha looked at Ananda and said, "Not so, Ananda, not so. This is the whole of the holy life. Because without these supports, we couldn't do this holy life at all." The Buddha himself did not come out of the egg, as it were, fully awakened. He needed his own teachers. He needed his own processes. He needed, as the story has it, a woman to feed him when he was on the edge of starvation, which was the turning point for him, away from asceticism, toward the middle way, and then ultimately to his own, and soon after actually, to his own awakening. So we need that which is seemingly outside us. But is it actually outside us at all? In a way, what I think the Buddha is saying when he says this is the whole of the holy life is that the division between inner and outer is really quite arbitrary. And actually, it's very, very porous. We are buoyed, we are fed, we are lived, we are loved by so many forces. And the distinctions between us and them are very, very blurry, which goes to one of the fundamental teachings in Buddhism of interdependent arising, that everything arises due to causes. I think of the universe in some ways like this kind of vast sort of net, or like a trampoline. That's a traditional metaphor as well, Indra's net. But it's like a vast tapestry, and any wiggling in it ripples through the tapestry as a whole and lifts us. We're continually lifted. It's as if we're, you've probably done this, you know, maybe floating in the ocean in a very comfortable way, maybe with a life jacket on, or one of my favorite things, I remember doing this with our daughter for hours in Hawaii, would be to sit on these sort of boogie boards and just sit, and these big swells lift you, and sometimes you'll be lifted up, and sometimes you'll be in a trough, and a 10-foot swell will be above you, and you'll see a fish swimming in that swell, you know, 6 feet above your head in that moment. And then the wave comes through and lifts you up and passes on. Well, we really live our life in that way. All these waves passing through us, physical, material waves, waves of evolution, waves of culture, and certainly very local waves of all the people in our personal life, all the people who carry us along. And reflecting on community, Sangha, for tonight, I found myself having a very novel idea. Usually when people talk about the Dharma, in a sense, it's an argument for futility. In other words, it's the idea that our normal strategy of reaching for things and trying to essentialize them and stabilize them is doomed. It's a fundamentally frustrating strategy. And it's the act of, it's the enactment of that doomed, futile strategy again and again and again. That's the fundamental engine of suffering. That's the essence of the teaching, the way it's usually presented. I think it's true. I think it really is true. Things are changing so fast, especially in your own experience, your own phenomenology, that the instant you try to grab onto them or grapple with them, you're in trouble. But here's the other side of it, which relates to the Buddha's statement to Ananda. Not so, Ananda, not so. Maybe the other side of the Dharma, the other way of looking at it, is that it's not just that this strategy is doomed, as it were, but that it's unnecessary. We don't have to do it. We don't need to grabble and scratchle along, because we're already so profoundly buoyed and fed by everything that is. That's pretty remarkable. That, in other words, awareness itself is always here and available to us. Thoughts and feelings, sensations, sounds, sights, tastes, touches arise and pass away like little tiles, if you will, in the mosaic of this moment of experience. But awareness is like the grout, right? And you can even do these little thought experiments. I read one like this quite recently. If you just think a thought deliberately, like dog, or I have a bus, or I have a coat, whatever, I have a cup. And then watch the experience for about a half second to second right after the end of that thought. You have this funny awareness of a fundamentally kind of present, awake, impersonal, profoundly peaceful, utterly undisturbed, utterly composed, in a sense, quality of mind. And so awareness is continually feeding us the ultimate unconditioned that everything arises out of and passes away into. That's feeding us. And then think of all the good people, all the love we've received, all the caring, all the good qualities in our own heart. You know, your own goodness, your own fairness, your own grit, your own wishing well, your own good intentions. Maybe your performance is not perfect. I talked about that a couple weeks ago. But your intentions can be pure. So maybe the truth of things is it isn't just that it's hopeless to try to grasp after things and live from craving, but weirdly, it's actually not necessary. Our habit is to do it again and again and again, but if you actually experience or just feel into. What is it like to just be? Just being? As in the meditation tonight? Or what is simply being aware like? I'm not talking mystically about cosmic consciousness, but ordinary awareness, you know, the grout between the tiles. It's like in those states, there's no problem. There's really no need to grasp. Obviously, if your hand's on the hot stove, you pull it back. If you're thirsty, you drink. But that doesn't need to be craving involved in that, because you feel there really is no basis for that craving. So in a lot of ways, what Buddhism is about, I think, is exploring and bringing it closer and closer to home. What is it like to live on the basis of no craving? What's that like? Not contracted, not scarce, not straining, no pressure. In a certain radical way, quite abandoned to the way it is, quite given up, and yet also incredibly juiced by all this amazing stuff flowing through you each moment. So it's like how to live that way more and more, how to kind of make room for it, and create sanctuary for it. A great way into this feeling is through feeling really fed, so that the little lizard and rat and monkey inside each one of us feels handled. It's okay. You know, as I've talked about, you know, pet the lizard, feed the rat, hug the monkey. You know, they're okay, right? They can relax. So in a moment, I want to do a two-step sort of process with you. And in the first step, if you're up for it, and you can always opt out, as always, anything, I'll invite you to find a partner. And then with your partner, you'll pick an A and a B. One person will mainly speak, one person will mainly listen. A's will be the first speaker, then you'll switch roles, the usual. And this will be brief, and I think I'll try to do this for a couple different partners. When you talk, when you're the speaker, see if you can talk about and open to the experience of, even as you're talking, what lifts you? What carries you? What are you grateful for? What are you thankful for? What are you glad about? What gives you a darn good ride? Whatever that is. And including just kind of free associating. And so then if you're the listener, your job is really simple. It's just to receive the speaker. And in particular, see the truth for that person of those things that she or he is really fed by, really lifted by. Okay? Is that pretty clear? Want to try that? It sounds like a pretty fun thing to do, I don't know, to me, on the eve of Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm.